Twin City Federal presents Minnesota Milestones. From sodbusters to soil banks, the story of agriculture. This is the story of Minnesota, sodbusters to soil banks. A true story of the land and of the people who work the land. This is the second in a series of 12 hour-long special broadcasts in honor of Minnesota's 1958 statehood centennial. A year-long series we call Minnesota Milestones. I'm E.W. Zebarth.
I'm Cedric Adams.
And I'm Bob DeHaven.
We will tell the story of you. Of you who now farm these lands of Minnesota, of your grandfathers and your forebears. This is the story of the first settlers who homesteaded and felled the trees and cleared the land and chopped the sod, the sodbusters. It is the story of never-ending change and people changing to new ways and new methods. A story of crops and dairying and poultry, of milking time, of trial and hardship. A story, too, of success. And above all, this is another story of a wilderness that grew to greatness. The story of another series of Minnesota milestones. Minnesota, sodbusters to soil banks. And the prairie grass stretched westward beyond the hardwood forests of southern Minnesota, wave on wave, as far as the eye could see. And in the north there were the pines, endless, cool, green, broken only by the rippling waters of the lakes and the silver flashing rivers. And when spring came in the mid-1800s, they came, the settlers came, winter's icy grip at last unlocked. The southwesterly breezes caressed the land, and the land responded and turned fresh and green. That's when they came, along the rivers and over the rutted trails. It was in June, in 1863, that they came, Emil and Anna Schultz and their 5-year-old son Hans. And they climbed the hills, turned, paused, and looked at the flatlands of the Minnesota River spread with willows. At the raw settlement of New Ulm across the river 2 miles away, and they pressed onward over the hills. 6 miles north of town, the man at the land office had said, and there it was, their land. Emil ripped away the prairie grass and clutched eagerly at the earth, working loose a handful of rich black loam.
Anna, Anna, we have reached the promised land. We have. Anna! Our land, Anna. No, but Anna, why do you cry? Ended is our journey. Anna, we are landowners now. As farmers we are. Be happy, Anna. It's a new world.
Oh, forgive me, Emil. Oh, Emil, it's happy I am. But Emil, we poor in Deutschland. Now we are so poor, we don't even have a house. No house, Emil. Oh, Emil is frightened. I am. Such a big country.
Having no house, Anna, that makes no matter. Build a house we will, and a barn, and having we will cows and oxen and chickens. Anna, we is rich. Rich, Anna. We have land. Land, land.
Yes, they had their land. 160 acres of rich southern Minnesota prairie land. And Anna had her house. The prairie supplied that, too. Emil did as his neighbors did. He hewed chunks of sod, wrenched it loose from the virgin earth. He built it block upon block, a sod house. He was a sod buster.
But that's not where agriculture began in Minnesota. Way back in the days of the voyageurs, Father Hennepin found the Indians had their small patches of corn and truck gardens. Pioneer agriculture in Minnesota really began in 1840. Joseph Haskell and James S. Norris settled near Afton. And here's something that'll make you farmers smile today. Back there in the 1850s, the Minnesota Pioneer assured farmers,
"There's no danger of glutting the market. Cultivate all the land you can, all of you, 100 farmers, where now you have one, and you'll all be secure of high prices for years to come."
The land was new and rich, the soil fertile. And by 1860, the value of products ground in Minnesota's grist mills were greater than the value of lumber produced in the state. And so, it came to pass that in 1860, a visitor to the Minnesota State Fair held at Fort Snelling was able to report,
"Minnesota can beat the world for wheat, oats, corn, potatoes, turnips, squashes, beets, and onions."
That was frontier boasting, of course. But the man did see corn 17 feet tall, a cabbage weighing 28 pounds, and an 18-pound radish for sale. So it was no wonder that Governor Alexander Ramsey spoke his flowery best at that same state fair.
Ladies and gentlemen, allow me to congratulate you upon the auspicious day that has witnessed this occasion. 3 years ago, when the financial sirocco swept over this country, many thought it was the day of our death. But as in all nature, we have arisen from that death, beautiful and bright. Before that crisis, Minnesota had nearly 100,000 bushels of wheat for export. Now she has 5 million bushels of wheat to relieve the famishing people of other lands. Minnesota is not only a good agricultural country, but its people are eminently a religious people. God enjoins it upon us to turn our swords into plowshares and our spears into pruning hooks. But do more than this. We take possession of the best fortress in the United States and make it subservient to the cause of agriculture.
And those were milestone years for Minnesota back there in the early 60s. Our state was slowly becoming agriculturally important. The great era of wheat raising lay ahead. Each steamer that docked in St. Paul brought more and more settlers. The railroads were just starting to reach out. The young land, the infant land of Minnesota, was starting to grow.
And Emil Schultz has prospered. Even as he promised Anna they would prosper when they stood there on the hills 15 years ago. It's called the Schultz Place now, and the neighbors have a tone of envy in their voices when they say it, too. It's June again, and all the neighbors are gathered, hard-working German folk. There's a barn raising at the Schultz Place this day, and the men are straining under the bulk of the timbers, and the women are working in the kitchen, fixing dinner.
Help my sister here. Push my steady now. Up with the joists.
All day, that's the way it had been. Since dawn, when the neighbors arrived with their wagons, sawing, pounding, shouting, laughing, joking, and working. Emil had worked for days with Hans and his second son, Peter, helping to haul the timbers up from the river bottom. They had cut them square and sharp and true. They had to haul the siding and the shingling 6 miles from the railroad. And while the women worked in the kitchen and chatted about sewing and cooking and about church tomorrow, the hammering and the pounding lasted the whole day.
Emil! Emil! How about a drink of beer now?
No. Beer gibt's nicht. Raise the barn first, then you drink the beer.
Yeah, that's right, Dave.
All right.
About half an hour before sundown it was when the barn raising was done, and all the neighbors gathered in the barnyard, and then came the dance in the new barn. Emil Schultz had prospered. That first winter in the sod house, they lived on game that Emil shot. And in the summer, it was work, back-breaking work from sunrise to dark. Their second son, Peter, was born in 1865. Emil bought a yoke of oxen. He was able to build a frame house by 1875, and now a barn newly raised for his cattle.
But sod houses with walls 3 to 4 feet thick continue to dot the prairie lands of southern and southwestern Minnesota until the 1890s. Make no mistake about it, the life of the settler was hard. One of three things happened to the pioneer farmer in Minnesota. He managed to hang on year after year, or he was driven out by grasshoppers, drought, hail, and flood. Or he prospered. And the sod house, while it was cool in the summer and warm in the winter, crumbled gradually under summer storms, winter snows, the frost, and the field mice. And in the timber areas, the log cabin was home. A traveler through early northern Minnesota described one.
16 by 18 feet it was, plastered with mud. There was a huge fireplace and a mud chimney pushed out at one end. And this small room served as kitchen, parlor, bedroom, pantry, cellar, and for all other purposes. Only one chair had a back on it. For seats, a large trunk, two stools, and two empty boxes. There were two beds filled with prairie feathers. Straw, that is. The settler and his wife occupied one, myself and my friend the other, while the children made a bunk on the floor.
For light, the early settlers used a rag wick, burning in a pot of fat. The first kerosene lanterns came out in 1859, and their use gradually spread. A farm wife reports,
"We had our first kerosene lamp in 61. We were terribly frightened of it. It could burn all we owned, and it smelled terrible. But that didn't keep us from being very proud of it."
Wood was the main fuel, but in the prairie regions, tight twists of hay were used instead. And what a job it was to keep warm with hay twists on a cold winter's day. In the very early days, out in the western parts of Minnesota, they burned buffalo chips. They seemed to make a good fire, but they had certain drawbacks. Sir Richard Burton, after one of his travels through the Midwest, remarked,
"I must say, a steak cooked over buffalo chips requires no pepper."
And the frontier wife had to cook, help her husband in the field, do the spinning, weaving, and tailoring. There was the job of soap making and making the dye. The settler's wife commented,
"Oh, the old blue dye tub. Such an odor was never on land or sea as in the old dye pot. I am too modest to tell you what we used to dissolve the indigo. But the blue never faded."
And there were wolves in those days. The St. Peter Tribune told the story way back in 1879.
"There was wolf seen last Sunday in the village of Ottawa. If the farmers don't turn out and kill these wolves, they will eat up the villagers. The wolf was literally at the door."
And there were other nuisances. Get this bit of early settler's doggerel.
"The little wretch that closest clings, the thing that most our patience stings, is the nasty little mosquito."
Indeed, the mosquito tried the patience of the settler, but it was the grasshopper horde, sky-filling millions of grasshoppers, which tried their very souls and left them despairing. It was a summer day back there in the 1870s. In the clear, bright July morning, Anna Schultz was working in the garden. She picked the vegetables for dinner, peas and string beans and onions and lettuce. She noticed with a glow of pride the tomatoes were just setting, for the kitchen garden was her pride. Back in the kitchen, she hummed as she went about her chores, and as the sun stood high, she stepped out the door and rang the dinner bell.
And the wheat, Papa, the wheat. This is going to be our best year yet. Papa, I bet we get 30, maybe 40 bushels to the acre this year.
Yeah, that's good wheat. Then we start harvest next week, I think.
Papa, can I drive the oxen this year? Last year you said that I could.
Yeah, I know what I said.
Peter, be a good kind and run to the well before dinner.
Now, Mama, you promised me you wouldn't call me that anymore.
Oh, that's right, I did promise. Peter, I'm sorry. Now go get the Wasser.
All right, Mama.
And Peter.
Yes?
Dark it's getting. Maybe a storm is blown up. See about the oxen, will you?
All right, give me the bucket, will you?
Hans.
Yeah, Papa.
Did you wash?
Yeah,
oh,
Papa.
Emil, no, leave the boy alone.
Hey, Papa! Mama, Hans, quick! Yeah, that's no storm, Papa. Papa, it's grasshoppers!
And the dinner lay neglected at the table. The Schultzes sprang into action. Anna beating, flailing, soaring, buzzing, roaring horns, swarming over her prize garden. Hans and Emil ran to set fire to the wheat, the golden wheat, their best crop ever. Peter banged with a shovel, smashing thousands of hoppers, only to have thousands take their place. And the combined sound of the chewing, the chopping, and the tearing of leaves and the stems sounded like a roaring prairie fire. It was the middle of the afternoon and it was over. The grasshopper hordes had moved on. There was no thing, no blade of grass, no wheat, no kitchen garden, no tomatoes just setting in the July sun. Only the barn, the house, and the rail fences. The center of a vast desert. And the grasshoppers came again and again and again. And so did the chinch bugs. The evil smell of their tiny bodies blown on the wind as they advanced. The poisonous, hand-swelling, pesky chinch bugs. Another hated spoiler there on the farm. But ahead, there's a new day. Farmer realizing that he must stand shoulder to shoulder with his neighbor to stand or fall together. A new word is being heard over the land, cooperative. And another, diversification. A new era is coming. The beginnings of farm machinery. Chemical methods to control these crop-eating insects. All this lies ahead as Minnesota farming reaches another milestone. We may turn from Minnesota history to your personal future. I'd like to make a prediction. 1, 2, 3 years from today, you'll be enjoying much greater progress, more security, more happiness, if during those years you own and add to a savings account. There indeed is a safe prediction, friends. And here is a safe place to fulfill it. Twin City Federal, the $250 million savings institution. Safe, because Twin City Federal investments are safe. Safe because accounts are backed by large contingency reserves. And safe, finally, because accounts are insured for safety by the Federal Savings and Loan Insurance Corporation, a permanent agency of the United States government. Twin City Federal, of course, is so conveniently located, 8th and Marquette in Minneapolis, 6th and Robert, St. Paul, where the twin clock flashes the time and the temperature. Why not stop in? Enjoy progress through saving. Safe progress with the $250 million savings institution, Twin City Federal. Plenty of free parking right at the door, too. And now Dr. Zebarth continues our milestone story of Minnesota agriculture.
One night they decided, Papa, Mama, Hans, and Peter, seated there around the table in the big kitchen. Supper dishes had been cleared away. Really, Papa decided, because after all, Papa was head of the house. Many a winter's night, there under the flickering kerosene lamp, they had talked. And now it was all settled. Peter had said it over and over and over again. Peter, young, slim, 19, and restless, eager to try the world, to see what it would bring.
But I do love the farm, Papa. I'll never forget it, not so long as I live. But, well, Papa...
Love your farm, boy. Yeah. But do you love the land? Nein. Hans here loves the land. He does. The land he handles like a woman, like a wife, like a baby, like a family. Love the land. You must love the land to be a good farmer.
But, Papa, I love machinery, too. The steam engines and the reapers, they're getting better all the time, Papa. You see, you don't use the oxen anymore, and why? Because the horse does it better. And someday, Papa, machinery will do it better yet.
Ah, that means nothing. Horses we have for 100 years. Pulling machinery will the horses, yeah. But never will you replace the horses. Never.
And so it was all arranged, because Emil indulged his second son. Peter would go to town, maybe even all the way to Minneapolis, to learn about farm machinery. And Hans, who had married and had a baby and who lived in a little house he and Emil had built on the Schultz place, Hans would stay on the farm with Papa. But one thing Papa wanted. Hans had to work to pay Peter his rightful share of the farm. That's why he left the old country, Papa said forcefully. The oldest son always got the land.
This is not the old country. We are in America now. Do it the American way. That's the way we will do it, you bet.
And so there were partings. Anna sobbed. Papa and Peter were both moist-eyed, even Hans, too, as he shook hands with his brother. And they all stood, Papa, Mama, Hans, his wife Hilda, with the baby in her arms, and waved as Peter mounted his horse and rode along the dusty road southward, over the hills, across the willow-covered flatlands of the Minnesota River to town. And Emil knew about farm machinery now slowly appearing on the land. He was too sharp a farmer not to notice. He had started with the sickle and the cradle and the flail. Yes, he had carved his own plow from a stump. He had made his own drags of wood, then had tipped the teeth with metal. Emil had one of the first cast iron plows sold at the general store, and no one was more delighted than he with the steel plow when he first saw it, a plow that would actually scour. Emil knew all about the McCormick Reaper, the Easterly, and the Manny. He had a self-binding reaper himself, a machine that caused him the loss of several cattle because of the chewed-up bits of wire it mixed with the feed grain. But binder twine overcame that hazard. Emil used the horsepower thresher, too.
Ah, I know what came next, Zebarth, old chum. This is a story I simply have to tell. And a lot of you will remember it, too. The instrument that dominated the farm scene for nearly 40 years, the Monster. The most fascinating of all inventions ever to hit the farm, the steam engine. Do you remember when you were a kid, the one sound that sent you running full tilt across the meadows? Well, here it is. There they are, back again, the three blasts of the whistle. A sign that the harvesting crew was about finished at the next farm, and soon it would be coming along the dusty road, dragging the thresher, lumbering, grinding on the stones, hissing steam, belching forth black smoke. And this is the way it used to be, too, do you remember? So loud you could scarcely hear yourself. And then it began. My, what an exciting day. The crew, the threshing crew, all in place, the spike pitcher, the separator man, the water tender, and the bagger. You remember all the farmers with their wagons and teams? And you remember that smell of grease and steam combined with the hot July sun? And then that delightful odor of the newly cut straw. And you remember the slap, slap, slap of the big leather belt that ran from the engine back to the separator. Sometimes the spike pitcher didn't toss the bundles in right and the belt came off. And my, do you remember the language? We won't even try to recreate that for you. Ah, there's the whistle. It's noon, dinner time. And back in the farmhouse, the ladies have been working all morning in the kitchen. The table is heaped with fried chicken and roast pork and roast beef. potatoes, carrots, and peas, and scalding hot coffee. There was apple pie and lemon pie, homemade, of course. Do you remember the pickled apples, the coleslaw, even some raw carrots from the kitchen garden? Potatoes boiled and mashed, mountains of them with rich brown gravy. I wish I had some right now. An expression has come down from that era in our history, eat like a threshing crew. And they certainly did.
But Cedric, those boys worked harder than you do. They burned up all those calories they gulped down.
Steady, fat boy, steady. But you're right. They had started as soon as the dew was gone and raced the sun across the sky. After dinner, they were right back at it. The straw stack grew taller and taller. The wagons kept circling round and round the fields, and the choking dust blew and swirled around the rig. If you were a water tender, then you well remember how the sun got hotter and hotter, and you had to work faster and faster. The hotter the day, the more water. Always more water. But more wagon loads of the golden, rich treasure of the earth moved safely into the granary. Golden kernels that had escaped the threat of drought, grasshoppers, hail, and rust. And that was the reward, the great reward for toil. The farmer counted his blessings, every kernel of them, as the sun sank down out of sight and the coolness of evening pressed down on the rising heat from the stubbled fields. And there, wheat and straw, mountains of them. More straw than a farmer could use to bed old Prince and Maud, indeed. And so, in the quiet evenings, he burned it. And you could see straw stacks burning great torches as far as the eye could reach on a still late summer night. A dozen, maybe 20 of them. Signals of a harvest completed. You don't see the steam engines much anymore, just a few of them around. And some folks with memories bring them out once a year. But it's not like it used to be when men battered the steam engine the whole livelong day. And now, when the combine goes more quietly, powered by a purring gasoline or diesel engine, much more quietly through the fields, don't you have a longing to hear that sound just once more? As you and I watch Minnesota's progress unfold on these programs, I expect you share with me a deep sense of respect for the hard work and perseverance put forth by our people. And it's important, I think, that we remind ourselves of another fact. Thrift is a partner in almost every success. Thrift provides the funds with which to take advantage of opportunity. Thrift helps self-confidence, too, the springboard of personal initiative. And because this holds true today, even more than it did in the past, why not take advantage of the saving facilities offered at Twin City Federal? Accounts are insured for safety by a permanent agency of the United States government. And the current dividend rate is 3.5% compounded quarterly. And that, my friends, is the top rate in town on insured savings. You're invited to enjoy these advantages no matter where you live. Thousands of persons throughout all of Minnesota and our great Northwest do so by participating in Twin City Federal's Save by Mail plan. For complete information, write to me personally, Cedric Adams here at WCCO, St. Paul or Minneapolis. There's no obligation, and I'll see that you get full details. You're listening to Minnesota's Milestones from your Centennial Station, St. Paul and Minneapolis, WCCO. And here is Dr. Zebarth to continue our story.
At first, they were settlers there in the prairies and in the wooded lands where the stumps were grubbed out by the roots. But they became farmers. And they were tied together by the uncertainties of weather, drought, grasshoppers, hail, the fluctuating market, the need for money, never enough money. That brought them together. And way back in 1867, one of agriculture's great pioneers, Oliver Hudson Kelly, had founded the Grange, a secret society, something like Freemasonry, with a password and rites and initiations. The Grange Hall was the social center of the farm community, and that's where the farmers met and talked over their common troubles. And they had troubles, plenty of troubles. Yes, Hans had had his lean years, and there came the bad year, the year when hail flattened the wheat. Hans, with his 12-year-old son Emil on the wagon beside him, drove to the elevator in town. It was a glum Hans who stared straight ahead. It was poor wheat. There was the note at the bank, $500. About the sacks in the wagon, Hans thought, not only poor wheat, but because of the hail, not much of it either. He wheeled the wagon onto the weighing scale.
Hello, John.
Oh, Hans. Here he was hailed out.
Yep.
Bad.
Bad. That's it in the wagon. See, you're posting 69 cents. Is that right?
Yeah.
Adolf told me it was 73 yesterday.
Was.
But why? In one day?
I don't know, Hans. Let's see. Some mustard here, Hans. A lot of weeds.
Oh, some, I guess.
Yeah. Won't grade no better than number two, Hans.
Two, huh?
Sorry.
After John figured the gross and the tear for the net, Hans took with heavy heart the slip of paper worth scarcely more than $60 and went to see the banker.
$500 is about right, Hans. The correct figure is $517.22.
Uh-huh. Maybe you heard I got hailed out. Here's all my crop was worth.
Well, Hans, the interest is nearly that much.
Does this mean you take the farm?
No, Hans. We won't foreclose on you. There'll be another crop next year. We'll try to carry you for another season.
I could pay the interest and still have some left for seed.
All right, Hans. That's a deal.
But Hans couldn't stop worrying about money. There were so many things needed at home. Times were tough, and Hans thought and thought all the way home. Then he nodded, smiling short, quick smiles at young Emil's animated chatter. And that night he talked it over with Hilda. They agreed that maybe they should sell old Bess. She's dry now, anyhow. Hilda said she did have her heart set on that new wet sink. Well, that could wait. School will be starting up, and young Emil and little Clara and Catherine will be needing shoes. $35 in hard times is $35, and that's what old Bess would bring. Next year may be a bumper crop, but that won't help now. And the next night after chores, Emil went to the Grange Hall in town, and he and Adolf talked it all over. And this was before the days of the ever-normal granary, before the government was called upon to help stabilize the farm economy. There were bumper crops and low prices. There were thin crops and low prices, too. Why did all this happen? They didn't know, but the farmers talked about it.
We should have our own elevator. Then we'll set the prices.
Well, don't know about setting prices, Hans, but maybe we'd have something to say about them.
Sounds good. Where do we get the money?
Where? From you and me and our neighbors, all of us.
There's three of us right here. Ain't got much now, but maybe next year we make out real good.
Say, I think Hank would join us. And that new sweet fella farming Gus's place. There's Olaf. He'd join.
How about Nels?
No, he wouldn't. I know he wouldn't.
And out of these meetings at the Grange Halls, due to the influence of Oliver Hudson Kelly, due to the Anti-Monopoly Party, the Greenback Party, and the Farmers' Alliance, there came two distinct trends. On the one hand, there came into being the cooperative elevator rising there at the rail side. On the other hand, government at last heard the cries of the farmers. And the result, in the 1880s and 1890s, rapid changes and improvements and new methods and new names in Minnesota agriculture. Here are some of the historic milestones.
1869, first classes were held at University Farm following the Land-Grant College Act of 1862. 1881, Minneapolis Grain Exchange organized. 1885, Minnesota Railroad and Warehouse Commission established. 1887, first trainload of cattle into the new South St. Paul Stockyards. 1889, the first cooperative cheese and butter factory at Biscay, another at Clark's Grove.
After the turn of the century, political upheavals on the farm front. The force of politics on the farm was strong.
Here's another story I remember very well. Even as the cooperatives were rising in influence, something else began to happen, even as it was happening in the small towns and in the cities. That's it, you guessed it. The tractor was beginning to show up on the farm, even as the gasoline buggy was appearing in the cities. It was way back in 1908 that International Harvester put out a single-cylinder tractor. Others followed: Hart Parr, Minneapolis Moline, John Deere, Universal, Waterloo Boy, J.I. Case, Holt, the Oil Pull. And then one day, young Emil came home from the farm school in St. Paul, and it was he who first put the idea in Hans's mind.
But that's not all, Dad. They're using tractors at the school, on the test plots. They talk about tractors and machinery, Dad.
And Papa Emil used to say, the horse will last for 100 years. Remember that, Hilda?
Yes, I remember, Hans.
Well, I don't know. The horse was good enough for my Pa, and I guess it's good enough for me.
But, Pa, sure, the horse is good enough for you now, today. But what about 5? What about 10 years from now?
Maybe you're right. Sometime I'll go talk to your Uncle Peter in town.
That was just the beginning of many arguments, some of them pretty bitter arguments, between Hans and young Emil. It's 1915, and young Emil is home, not working on the farm, but as a county agent.
Dad, I've been trying to get the farmers to plant alfalfa on their land. You know, you'd be a big help to me if you'd try it. Oh, the farmers in 3 counties around here respect you.
Yeah, I've been hearing about you and your alfalfa. Now, see here, Papa Emil never planted that alfalfa, and I ain't going to use it either. I've been farming for 40 years now, you and your fancy ideas.
And so the debate raged over tractors, over new crops, over use of fertilizers, but one argument really aroused Hans's wrath.
Switch to Thatcher wheat? Now you listen to me. I've been raising Marquis for over 40 years. Sure, I had some bad years, but I had some mighty good years, too. It was Marquis wheat fed you and raised you and sent you to that farm school in St. Paul.
But Hans was disturbed. Out there in the July heat, he had seen it growing worse every year. There was a lot of dust from the binder, yellowish dust. But now it was red, wheat rust, piling high on the binder, rust on the horse's harness, foaming red on the heaving sides. And at home, at night, his own face, his hands, his bandana, even his overalls, red with rust. No wonder Hans was worried. But Hans was too old to resist his son any longer. At last, he gave up management of the farm, and he and Hilda moved to town. But he complained every time he came out to the farm.
Silo? What on earth you want with all that corn in there for? Why, you'll sour the milk feeding cattle, that rotten stuff.
Now, wait a minute, Pa. Now, just let me show you the records.
And that's something else. Records, records, records. You'd think you wasn't running the government. The way you keep those records, I never saw so much paper in all my born days.
Hans was skeptical about the hybrid corn, about soil conservation and the new alfalfa. But grudgingly, he had to admit sometimes that Emil was right.
You got good wheat this year, son. That's just like it used to be back in the 90s. No rust. 35 bushel, I'd say. Hope you don't get hailed out now.
And somewhere over there, men were fighting again. They were always fighting in Europe, but wheat prices soared, even hit $1 a bushel and more. Farmers plowed and planted every acre they had, rented some besides, and they planted wheat and wheat and more wheat. Some farmers were lucky. They paid off all the mortgages and wound up with money in the bank. But most farmers were not prepared for what happened next: depression. And that meant the mortgages were coming back, foreclosures, and tough times. As we review the past on these programs, it's apparent that life is getting more and more complex, isn't it? And this means, among other things, of course, that there are more and more reasons for us as individuals to consider the necessity for saving money regularly. Thrift makes us adaptable, gives us the means to take advantage of changing job opportunities, the means to acquire new machinery, new equipment, to make life and work a lot more efficient, more pleasurable. Best of all, perhaps, thrift gives us an underlying sense of security and progress in this fast-progressing world. And for safe progress, swifter progress, I'd like to invite you most cordially to save at Twin City Federal. Accounts are insured for safety by a permanent agency of the United States government. The current dividend rate, you know, is 3.5% compounded quarterly, and that is the top rate in town on insured savings. Enjoy progress through saving at Twin City Federal, the $250 million savings institution. So conveniently located, 8th and Marquette in Minneapolis, 6th and Robert in St. Paul, where the twin clock flashes the time and the temperature. Plenty of free parking right at the door. We continue now with our Minnesota Milestone. This was the day of the speechmakers. Every year at the county fair, there was a farm rally with a speaker talking about the farm situation.
And do they care about us dirt farmers in Wall Street? Do they care about us in Washington? Now tell me, what do your cows do when the wind blows up a storm? They huddle together for protection, don't they? Now the trouble with us farmers is, we don't have the same sense that our critters has. Organization! That's what we gotta do. We got to get together.
Following that call to organize, farmers did, and in huge numbers. Co-ops, Land O'Lakes, Minnesota's biggest dairy cooperative, the Twin City Milk Producers Federation. There were other dairy co-ops, grain marketing co-ops, shipping associations, insurance co-ops, telephone co-ops, consumer co-ops. Farm organizations in other fields formed, too. The Farm Bureau Federation and the Farmers Union, with its strong ally, the Grain Terminal Association, exerting political as well as economic influence. The Farmers' Sons and Daughters organized, too. T.A. Dad Erickson, hearing of the 4-H Club organized in Clarion, Iowa, brought the idea north up into Minnesota. It had a special appeal for the younger people out on the farms, made them more than just labor. It gave new meaning to farm chores, the thrill of accomplishment. And so did another young farmer organization, the Future Farmers of America, developed in Minnesota by Wayno Cordesmaki. The 4-H and FFA clubs of the 20s were the training ground for today's successful Minnesota farmers.
Take a breath a minute, will you, Cedric? I have a story I'd like to tell here. Yep, times were tough, and in the 30s they'd be still tougher. But we wouldn't be telling the whole story if we didn't relate the fun times. The Saturday nights when chores were done, when everybody packed up and went to town. Some went to that brand new thing just coming along, the movies. But for most folks, the adults, it was the country dance. It was also the era of Prohibition and Minnesota 13. To some folks, Minnesota 13 meant corn, but to others, it came in bottles.
How's your Minnesota 13 doing this year?
Just great. Got 40 bushels to the acre.
Yeah, but how many gallons did you get to the acre?
Here, have some.
The Sunday afternoon and the 4th of July baseball game was a big entertainment favorite among farm people. And then something new came on the scene. Remember this sound? The old Atwater Kent in its square box, three dials and a big horn on top. It was a familiar sight in the farm home. And with the radio came something the farmer never had before, instant news, market and weather information. And a young man came on the scene about then, back in the 30s. Remember him? Now, this is Cedric Adams with your noontime news.
All right now, Robert. You're not very kind. That sounded more like Rudy Vallee. I didn't start until 1935, and you're moving just a bit too fast. Let's back up now. Here was some news from the 20s.
President Coolidge today, for the second time, vetoed the McNary-Haugen Farm Bill. The president's comment was brief as he announced his veto of the $2,300,000 measure. He said it would cost too much money.
The McNary-Haugen Bill was only the first in a long line of federal legislation intended to bring direct relief to the farmer. Folks who thought times were bad back in the 20s found out how tough it really could be in the drought-ridden, dust-filled, impoverished Depression 1930s. Still burned in the memory of many of us now living are those trouble-ridden days. Corn was being burned in the schoolhouses. It was cheaper than coal. Farms were being sold at sheriff's sales for practically nothing. Good butcher hogs were selling at South St. Paul for 2 cents a pound. Do you remember the Federal Farm Board of the Hoover administration, headed by Bill Schilling of Northfield?
The Federal Farm Board was set up by Congress and given $500 million for the purpose of assisting cooperative marketing farm products. Land O' Lakes Creameries of St. Paul in Minneapolis got $3 million on about 1%. These institutions were set up for the assistance of cooperatives only.
Remember the Farm Holiday Association, organized by John Bosch of Renville County. In Washington, a new administration came into power and a new president, Franklin Delano Roosevelt, who said over the radio for the whole nation to hear,
"So first of all, let me assert my firm belief that the only thing we have to fear is fear itself. Nameless, unreasoning, unjustified terror, which paralyzes needed effort to convert retreat into advance."
And there was the Farmer Labor Government of Minnesota, Floyd Olson with his plan for a cooperative commonwealth. Henry Wallace became Secretary of Agriculture back there in 1933. The radio brought his voice into every farm back in those times.
"I am committed to stopping the creation of fear. It is not the Kremlin, not the communists who have sent milk to 24 cents a quart and meat to $1.30 a pound, that it is the red issue and not the Reds who did this to us."
Do you remember the AAA, the Committee of 25, the state AAA committee headed by Harry Muir of Winnebago? And then back there on the 6th of January, 1936, this news. The United States Supreme Court had ruled the Agricultural Adjustment Act unconstitutional. Congress passed a new law, and the program of controlling farm production went ahead. A prominent figure in agriculture, head of the Minnesota AAA and later head of the Production Marketing Administration that succeeded it, was Charles Stickney of Clear Lake.
"Well, in the late 30s and the early 40s, the program was working quite well and were pretty well accepted by most farmers. Along came World War II, and we produced more food than anybody thought was possible. In fact, we started to feed practically the entire world. Then, of course, after World War II was over and these foreign countries began to produce for themselves, we find ourselves pretty much in the same position we were in the late 30s and the early 40s.
And there were the big three of Minnesota agriculture, the late John Brandt of Land O' Lakes.
"You start out with just an idea, and those ideas were always focused in one direction, and those were focused in the direction of the development of a part of the agricultural factory that I think is the most important part of the factory, that is, the development of the merchandising end of our agricultural factory."
The late J.S. Jones of the Farm Bureau.
"Farm Bureau is a group of farm families united together for the purpose of advancing themselves socially, of securing educational opportunities, and securing economic equality for those same people."
William Moskrip of the Twin City Milk Producers Federation.
"Starting with our initial meeting in the St. Paul Courthouse in 1916 and following our organization in 1918, there came the indictment of the then executive committee consisting of John V. Irwin, Ed Nolan, R.B. Goodhue, since one of our state senators, W.F. Schilling of Northfield, and myself, under the State Antitrust Act. At that time, you were in violation of the Antitrust Act of both Minnesota and the nation. If two farmers, just two, attempted to sell their milk cooperatively to any handler.
And Norris Carnes of the Central Livestock Association.
It was organized to assist the livestock producers of this northwest area to market their livestock more economically and to place them in a position where they could be, where they could develop bargaining power through the control of the sale of a large volume. Or, in other words, the Central was organized for the express purpose of doing a better job of marketing livestock and to represent the interests of livestock producers wherever those interests may occur.
And so the farm debate continued to rage. And then it came. All at once it came. Mechanization. That had been just a word before, but now it burst upon the farm scene like a hailstorm there in the late 30s. Tractors, then rubber-tired tractors, even tractors with headlights. Hay balers, feed choppers, corn pickers, two-row corn pickers, cultivators, hydraulic equipment, RPMs of gasoline and diesel engines replaced horsepower and manpower. From acres of oats to gasoline for fuel. A revolution in agriculture, and the crude, chugging first tractor on the farm was the prologue. Farm problems were a big issue in the presidential election campaign of 1952. Down in southern Minnesota at Plowville, on a bright, windy September day, the candidate spoke, the Republican candidate, Dwight Eisenhower.
In the fields where I once shocked wheat, behind a horse-drawn binder, the harvest is now a one-man job with a self-propelled combine. But to me, the most significant fact of the revolution on the land is that the essential character of our agriculture has not changed. The family farm is still the mainstay. The farmer still wants to be his own boss, and I'm for that.
And the Democratic candidate, Adlai Stevenson.
Well, I frank to say I don't like acreage allotments and marketing quotas myself. I hope, we all hope, and we have good reason to hope, that a growing population and an expanding market will keep us from again needing controls for staple crops. But farmers have learned from bitter experience that we need these controls in reserve.
And so in this year, Minnesota's centennial year, farmers can look backward on progress undreamed of 100 years ago. And yet there are great unsolved problems. The farmers, the Emils of today, are telling their sons around the kitchen table when the chores are done.
Yep, there's no question about it, John. Why, back in the Depression, about 40% of the people of this country lived on farms. And today, just about 13%.
The farmer is aware that the political strength he built in the 20s and 30s is waning. And what has brought it about? The biggest, sometimes the noisiest revolution the world has ever seen. For the past 30 years have brought mechanization, science to farming, fewer farms, bigger farms, new chemicals to control the always pesky insects and weeds, DDT, 2,4-D, methoxychlor, Dieldrin, new crops. Crops like the soybean, now the number two cash crop in Minnesota. Following World War II, mechanization and other advances in agriculture produced surpluses and still more surpluses. Surpluses that poured into congressional halls in Washington. Surpluses that hung as a dead weight over the head of the embattled Secretary of Agriculture, Ezra Taft Benson, 1958. Surpluses, a tangle of good and evil. Production well beyond what Emil the Sodbuster ever dreamed. And this brought the soil bank, a new chapter in the government's long effort to stabilize the farm economy.
And what is the future for tomorrow's farmer? Already there is talk of still newer varieties in the atomic age, new developments, new wonders of science. The farm campus of the University of Minnesota and the experts who teach there are producing wonders that may assure mankind of an adequate food supply for all time. From their test plots, Dr. Elvin Stakeman and H.K. Hayes produced new strains of wheat, which saved wheat farmers everywhere from ruin. Thatcher, the best of these strains, maintains this region as breadbasket of the world. Dr. Stakeman's experiments in hydroponics hold forth the promise that the world's food could be grown in water, even if the world's topsoil should vanish in some future age. And Dr. W.E. Peterson of the university has developed a method for inoculating cows so that the milk they produce will provide protection against disease. Fascinating to the farmer of the future is the prospect that hail and drought will no longer ruin him. Can it be true? Can men learn to control the weather? Uncertain, sometimes devastating weather? And will the next 30 years bring as much change in farming as the past 30 years? The past 100 years? From sod buster to soil banks, from soil banks to what?